You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. In the last show, we were looking at the epilogue, subsection, A Time of Choice. The latest science leads us to a worldview not unlike that held by the earliest civilizations, in which every material object in nature was thought to possess a spirit. The universe is still thought of as one by a small number of Aborigines who survive. Aboriginal cultures do not make the usual distinctions among rocks, air, and humans. All are imbued with spirit and invisible energy. Doesn't this sound familiar? This is, in fact, the world of quantum physics in which matter and energy are completely entangled, and is the world of Gaia that I spoke of in Chapter 1, a world in which the whole planet is considered to be one living, breathing organism, which needs to be protected from human greed, ignorance, and poor planning. Never have we needed the insights of such a worldview more than now. When science has turned away from spirit, its mission dramatically changed. Instead of trying to understand the quote-unquote natural order, so that human beings could possibly live in harmony with that order, modern science embarked on a goal of control and domination of nature. The technology that has resulted from pursuing this philosophy has brought human civilization to the brink of spontaneous combustion by disrupting the web of nature. The evolution of our biosphere has been punctuated by 5 mass extinctions, including one that killed the dinosaurs. Each wave of extinction nearly wiped out all life on the planet. Some researchers believe, as I mentioned in Chapter 1, that we are deep into the 6th mass extinction. Unlike the others, apparently caused by galactic forces, such as perhaps comets, the current extinction is being caused by a force much closer to home, humans. As you sit on your porch and watch the sunset, note the spectacular color. The beauty in the sky reflects pollution in the air. As the world we know decays, the Earth promises us an even greater light show. Meanwhile, we are leading lives without moral context. The modern world has shifted from spiritual aspirations to a war for material accumulation. The one with the most toys wins. My favorite image for the scientists and technologists who have led us into this spiritless world comes from the Disney movie Fantasia. Remember Mickey Mouse as the hapless apprentice to a powerful sorcerer. The sorcerer instructs Mickey to do the chores in the lab while he is away. One of the chores is to fill a giant cistern with water from a nearby well. Mickey, who has been observing the sorcerer's magic, tries to bypass the chore by applying a spell to a broom, which turns it into a water bucket carrying lackey. When Mickey falls asleep, the robotic broom fills and then overfills the cistern, filling the lab. Upon awakening, Mickey tries to stop the broom, but his knowledge is so limited he fails and the situation gets even worse. The water takes over until the sorcerer, who does have the knowledge to quiet the broom, returns and restores balance. Here's how Mickey's predicament is described in the movie. This piece is a legend about a sorcerer who had an apprentice. He was a bright young lad, very anxious to learn the business. As a matter of fact, he was a little too bright because he had started practicing some of the boss's magic tricks before learning how to control them. Today's very bright scientists are Mickey mousing around with our genes in our environment without understanding how interconnected everything is on the planet is. A course of action bound to have tragic results. How then did we get to this point? There was a time when it was necessary for scientists to split from spirit, or at least the corruption of spirit by the church. This powerful institution was in business of suppressing scientific discovery when it was at odds with church dogma. It was Nicholas Copernicus, a savvy politician as well as a gifted astronomer, who launched the spirit/science split when he released to the public his profound manuscript, De Revolutibus Orbium Coelestium, on the revolution of the heavenly spheres. The 1543 manuscript boldly declared that the sun, not the earth, was the center of the heavenly spheres. This is obvious to us today, but in Copernicus' time it was heresy because his new cosmology was at odds with the infallible church, which had declared the earth to be the center of God's firmament. Copernicus believed that the Inquisition would destroy both him and his heretical beliefs, so he prudently waited until he was on his deathbed to publish his work. His concern for his safety was fully justified. 57 years later, Giordano Bruno, a Dominican monk who had the temerity to speak out and defend Copernicus's cosmology, was burned at the stake for this heresy. Copernicus outsmarted the church. It is hard to torture an intellectual when he is in his grave. Unable to kill the messenger, the church eventually had to deal with Copernicus's message. A century later, French mathematician and philosopher René Descartes insisted on using scientific methodology to examine the validity of all previously accepted truths. The invisible forces of the spiritual world clearly didn't lend themselves to such analysis. In the post-Reformation era, scientists were encouraged to pursue their studies of the natural world, and spiritual truths were relegated to the realms of religion and metaphysics. Spirit and other metaphysical concepts were devalued as unscientific because their truths could not be assayed by the analytical methods of science. The important stuff about life and the universe became the domain of rational scientists. If the science-spirit split needed any more reinforcement, it got it in 1859, when Darwin's theory of evolution made an instant splash. Darwin's theory spread across the globe like today's internet rumors. It was readily accepted because its principles dovetailed with people's experiences in breeding pets, farm animals, and plants. Darwinism attributed the origins of humanity to the happenstance of hereditary variations, which meant that there was no need to invoke divine intervention in our lives or our science. Modern scientists were no less awed by the universe than the cleric scientists who preceded them. But with Darwin's theory in hand, they no longer saw a need to invoke the hand of God as a grand designer of nature's complex order. Preeminent Darwinist Ernst Mayr wrote, quote, "When we ask how this perfection is brought about, we seem to find only arbitrariness, plainliness, randomness, and accident." While Darwinian theory specifies that the purpose of life's struggles is survival, it does not specify a means that we should be used in securing that end. Apparently, anything goes in the perceived struggle because the goal is simply survival by any means. Rather than framing the character of our lives by the laws of morality, the neo-Darwinism of Mayr suggests that we live our lives by the law of the jungle. Neo-Darwinism essentially concludes that those who have more deserve it. In the West, we have accepted the inevitability of a civilization that is characterized by the haves and the have-nots. We don't want to deal with the fact that everything in this world has a price. Unfortunately, this includes, along with the ailing planet, the homeless, as well as the child laborers who sow our designer genes. They are the losers in this struggle. We are made in the image of the universe. On the early morning in the Caribbean, I realized that even the winners in our Darwinian world are losers because we are one with the bigger universe / God. The cell engages in behavior when its brain, the membrane, responds to environmental signals. In fact, every functional protein in our body is made of a complementary image of an environmental signal. If a protein did not have a complementary signal to couple with, it would not function. This means, as I concluded in that aha moment, that every protein in our body is a physical / electromagnetic complement to something in the environment. Because we are machines made out of protein, by definition we are made in the image of the environment, that environment being the universe, or you may call, as some may call, God. Back to winners and losers. Because humans evolved as complements to their surrounding environment, if we change the environment too much, we will no longer be complementary to it. In other words, we won't fit. At the moment, humans are altering the planet so dramatically, they are threatening our own survival as well as the survival of other rapidly disappearing organisms. That threat encompasses Hummer drivers and fast food Mongols with lots of money, the winners along with poverty-stricken laborers, the losers in this competition for survival. There are two ways out of this dilemma, to die or to mutate. I think you should seriously ponder this as the need to sell Big Macs lead us to decimate the rainforest, as the staggering numbers of gas-guzzling vehicles foul the air, or as petrochemical industries erode the earth and pollute the water. We were designed by nature to fit an environment, but it is not the environment that we are now creating. I learned from cells that we are part of the whole, and we forget this at our peril. But I recognize that each one of us has a unique biological identity. Why? What makes each person's cellular community unique? On the surface of our cells is a family of identity receptors, which distinguish one individual from another. A well-studied subset of these receptors, called self-receptors or human leukocytic antigens, or HLAs, are related to the functions of the immune system. If your self-receptors were to be removed, your cells would no longer reflect your identity. These self-receptor cells would still be human cells, but without an identity, it would simply be generic human cells. Put your personal set of self-receptors back on the cells, and they once again reflect your personal identity. When you donate an organ, the closer your set of self-receptors matches the receptors of the person is who is to receive the organ, the less aggressive the rejection reaction launched by the recipient's immune system. For example, let's say that a set of 100 different self-receptors on the surface of each cell is used to identify you as a unique individual. You are in need of an organ graft to survive. When my set of 100 self-receptors is compared to your self-receptors, it turns out that we only have 10 receptors that match. I would not be a great organ donor for you. The very dissimilar nature of our self-receptors reveals that our identities are very, very different. The vast difference in membrane receptors would mobilize your immune system, shifting it into hyperdrive to eliminate the foreign, i.e. not self-transplanted cells. You would have a greater chance of success if you could find a donor whose self-receptors more closely match the ones in your cells. In your search for a better donor, however, you will not find a perfect 100% match. So far, scientists have never found two individuals that are biologically identical, even identical twins. However, it is theoretically possible to create universal donor tissues when you remove the cell's self-receptors, though scientists have yet to carry out such an experiment. In such an experiment, the cells would lose their identity. These self-receptorless cells would not be rejected. While scientists have focused on the nature of these immune-related receptors, it is important to note that it is not the protein receptors, but what activates the receptors that gives individuals their unique identity. Each cell's unique set of identify receptors are located on the membrane's outer surface, where they act as antennas, downloading complementary environmental signals. These identity receptors read the signal of the self, which does not exist within the cell, which comes to it from the external environmental. Consider the human body as a television set. You are the image on the screen. Your image did not come from inside the TV. Your identity is an environmental broadcast that was received via your antenna. One day you turn on the TV and the picture tube is blown out. Your first reaction would be, oh, damn, the television is dead. But did the image die along with the television set? To answer that question, you get another television set, plug it in, turn it on, and tune it to the station you were watching before the tube blew out. This exercise will demonstrate that the broadcast image is still on the air, even though your first television died. The death of the television as the receiver in no way killed the identity broadcast that comes from the environment.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're looking at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. In the analogy as you as a television receiver, the physical television is the equivalent of the cell. The TV's antenna, which downloads the broadcast, represents our full set of identifying receptors, and the broadcast represents an environmental signal. Because of our preoccupation with the material Newtonian world, we might at first assume that the cell's protein receptors are the self. That would be the equivalent of believing that the TV's antenna is the source of the broadcast. The cell's receptors are not the source of its identity, but the vehicle by which the self is downloaded from the environment. When I fully understood this relationship, I realized that my identity, my self, exists in the environment whether my body is here or not. Just as in the TV analogy, if my body dies and in the future a new individual biological television set is born who has exactly the same identity receptors, that new individual will be downloading me. I will once again be present in the world. When my physical body dies, the broadcast is still present. My identity is a complex signature contained within the vast information that collectively comprises the environment. Supporting evidence for my belief that an individual's broadcast is still present even after death comes from transplant patients who report that along with their new organs come behavior and psychological changes. One conservative, health-conscious New Englander by the name of Claire Sylvia was astonished that she developed a taste for beer, chicken nuggets, and motorcycles after her heart-lung transplant. Sylvia talked to the donor's family and found out that she had the heart of an 18-year-old motorcycle enthusiast who loved chicken nuggets and beer. In her book called A Change of Heart, Sylvia outlines her personal transformation experiences as well as similar experiences with other patients in her transplant support group. Paul P. Parasol presents a number of such stories in the book, The Heart's Code, Tapping the Wisdom and Power of Our Heart Energy. The accuracy of memories that accompany these transplants is beyond chance or coincidence. One young girl began having nightmares of murder after her heart transplant. Her dreams were so vivid that they led to the capture of the murderer who had killed her donor. One theory about how these new behaviors become implanted into the transplant recipient along with the organ is cellular memory. The notion that somehow memories are embedded in cells. You know, I have immense respect for the intelligence of single cells, but I have to draw a line here. Yes, cells can remember that they are muscle cells or liver cells, but there is a limit to their intelligence. I do not believe cells are physically endowed with perception mechanisms that can distinguish and remember a taste for chicken nuggets. Psychologically and behavioral memory does make sense if we realize that the transplanted organs still bear the original identity receptors of the donor and are apparently still downloading the same environmental information. Even though the body of the person who donated the organs is dead, their broadcast is still on. They are, as I realized in my flash of insight, while mulling over the mechanics of the cellular membrane, immortal, as I believe we all are. Cells and organ transplants offer a model not only for immortality, but also for reincarnation. Consider the possibility that an embryo in the future displays the same set of identity receptors that I now possess. That embryo will be turned into myself. My identity is back, but playing through a different body. Sexism and racism become ridiculous, as well as immoral, when you realize that your receptors could wind up on a white person, a black person, an Asian, or male or female. Because the environment represents all that is, which some people call God, and our self-receptor antennas download only the narrow band of the whole spectrum, apparently we all represent a small part of the whole, a small part of God. Earthlanders. While the TV analogy is useful, it is not a complete one because the television is only a playback device. In the course of our lives, what we do alters the environment. We change the environment simply by being in it. So a more complete way of understanding our relationship to spirit is to compare a human to the Martian rover's spirit and opportunity, or the other NASA landers that have sent to the moon and to Mars. Humans are not yet able to go physically to Mars, but we really want to know what it would be like to land on Mars. So we send up the equivalent of a human explorer. Although the Mars rovers don't physically resemble a human, they have functions that are similar to the functions carried out by humans. These vehicles have cameras, which are the eyes that see the planet. These vibration detectors are the ears that hear the planet. They also have chemical sensors, which taste the planet. So the lander is designed with sensors that can experience Mars somewhat as a human would experience it if a human could live in that atmosphere. But let's look a little more closely at how the Mars rovers work. The rovers have antennas, known as receptors, that have tuned to receive information broadcast by a human being in the form of a NASA controller. The Earthbound controller actually sends information that animates the mariner on Mars. But the information is not a one-way street. The NASA controller also learns from the lander because the vehicle transmits information about its Mars experiences back to Earth. The NASA controller interprets the information about the lander's experiences and then applies that new awareness to better navigate the Martian terrain. In future shows, we're going to be looking about how it is possible to use the metaphor that you and I are like Earth landers who receive information from an environment controller spirit. As we live our lives, the experiences of our world are sent back to the controller, our spirit. So the character of how you live your life influences the character of yourself. This interaction corresponds to the concept of karma. When we understand it, we must take heed of the life we live on this planet, because the consequences of our life last longer than our bodies. What we do during our lifetime can bring us back to haunt us, or the future version of ourselves. So we're going to be looking at this in more detail, so please stay tuned for future shows.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.